You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. Well, sort of sunny.
Mostly sunny is the official term that the National Weather Service is using. Today's date, as Lois and I are preparing this broadcast, is April 17th, 2024, for broadcast on April 18. And late this morning, as we're doing this, it's 63 degrees, at least in Sacramento, going up to a high today of 76. Here are some magic numbers for you folks. Tonight's low temperature will be 52 degrees. Thursday, 78 and sunny. Thursday night, 52 degrees, mostly cloudy, interestingly. Friday, sunny, 78 degrees. Friday night, 50 degrees and mostly clear. Saturday, sunny, 79 degrees. Oh my. Saturday night. Folks, I'm a nursery retailer. When I see those numbers, I feel tired already. Saturday night, 51 degrees and clear. Sunday, sunny and 80 degrees.
You may have to put on more staff, Don.
I don't have any more. Sunday night, mostly clear, 50 degrees. Monday, sunny with a high near 75. Monday night, dipping down to 48 degrees. And Tuesday, sunny with a high near 72. Let's look at the long-range forecast real quick and see what they're saying further out. The ensembles, or the models as they describe it, show ridging through the weekend, which means dry weather and above normal temperatures. Okay, there's some uncertainty about what will follow that weak troughing developing early next week, which could be a storm, but only slightly cooler temperatures across the region. Near normal temperatures were expected by midweek, with forecast highs in the mid to upper 70s across the valley, basically for the next 10 days. What does that mean, Lois?
It's time to plant tomatoes. Well, at least Farmer Fred thinks it's time to plant tomatoes, because on his latest April 15th, and he posted, and I quote, plant tomatoes when the nighttime temperatures is steady above 50 degrees. This is from nursery owner Don Shore. And then he lists the Sacramento County forecast, and it's like 74 in the day and 53 at night, and none of those get below 50.
That's correct. We're hitting a very magic number. The soil temperature, this is really important. Last Saturday, we did not get above 46 degrees in Davis the entire day. We spent...
Wait a minute.
Daytime high. We spent, and I have actually never seen this in April before here, 27 hours below 50 degrees here in the Sacramento Valley, or at least in Davis, and that was true pretty much in our whole part of California here. Temperatures 15 to 20 degrees below average. It was cold. It was not really raining, but we got some. And obviously that was not great for business, but more to the point, the measured soil temperature at the Simms weather station that I followed dropped in a 48-hour period, dropped 5 degrees. So I had a lot of questions about what about the plants that are in the ground? Well, that's a problem. We can get into that in a moment. But more to the point, what we're seeing now, I've had signs up over the tomato plants at my garden center for, 3 weeks now. It's too early. It's too cold. Peppers and eggplants and basil are in the greenhouse, et cetera, et cetera. Every single day, of course, a conversation with people. It's not too hard to explain to them when it's 46 degrees that it's a little too cold for those little guys to go out in the ground. But we are now warming up nicely. This is the trend we like to see. The nighttime temperatures, I do consider 50 degrees kind of an absolute floor for planting tomato seedlings. My own personal rule is 55 for peppers and eggplant and 60 for members of the cucumber squash family. So I did write a quick thing about the effect of that cold temperature that we just went through on plants that are already in the ground. This is a case where early planting could really have some adverse impact on those young seedlings that you had already put out there. But we're now on the other side of that discussion. We're going into warmer temperatures, steady trend like we want it to be. The calendar tells us the same thing. It is time to go ahead and start planting tomatoes. The soil temperature is quickly moving back up to where it should be. And those nighttime temperatures, as I say, my 50 degree four appears to be there at least for the next 7 to 10 days. And we're in mid to late April. So it is time to start planting tomatoes.
Now, when you say peppers and eggplants, that's a group, and you have the cucumbers and watermelons, and that's a group. Yep. Does tomatoes have anything with it to be a group with? It's tomatoes and tomatoes?
Nah, tomatoes are their own group. They're the number one. They are the number one vegetable everybody's asking about. It's like, what's the very earliest I can plant them? And of course, we have lots of people that stuck them in the ground a month ago. The farmers, by the way, in this area, the Yolo County's canning tomatoes are still the number one crop here. About a week ago, many of them were out planting. Now, we see that. And it's funny how I have this conversation with people. How come they're planting and you're saying it's too cold? I said, well, walk out in those fields and look at those tomato seedlings. I can
assure you. And they'll be purple and shivering.
Yeah, they're purple, they're cold, they're not growing. They plant them because they're available. They buy them by the tens of thousands. I know the grower that does them, and they ship when they can ship them, and they plant when they can plant them, and the soil is workable. And they also have a different production goal. They're aiming to get those plants in the ground as early as possible. They're varieties that tend to set and hold early. They are aiming for a single crop to be harvested all at once, typically July, maybe August, some of them as late as September. They're working on a cannery contract. And I can assure you, if they were planting, you know, Better Boy or Champion and staking them up, they would get way more pounds per acre. They also couldn't get any way to harvest them. So agricultural operations are not a good guide when to do things for your backyard, but you are correct. If you put them in early, they will probably shiver their way through till appropriate temperatures, and they're getting back to those appropriate temperatures now. But I did want people to know what they're seeing or likely to see because of last week's cold temperature, even though we're now flipping around to where we really need to be. I mean, with 28 hours below 50 degrees, average high on that date last Saturday should have been 70. It was 46. Okay. Soil temperature dropped 5 degrees in 24 hours. So most of the plants that we're putting in for summer are subtropical and tropical plants, which are injured below about 55 degrees. Tomatoes, you know, there's a zillion varieties and they do vary. Tomatoes have been selected and bred for Siberia, Russia, Poland, Canada, places where it's really never totally perfect weather for them. So there are varieties that can take cold weather better than others. But the main thing to know is that cold injury, well, it's cumulative, it's also reversible. And as we warm up, they will outgrow them. They're typically fairly vigorous vines. They'll probably catch up. You may not have gained anything by early planting. You probably have not gained anything. We'll talk more about that. But the seedlings look kind of purple. Even in garden centers, they look kind of purple. That's technically a phosphorus deficiency, but it's not correctable. It's just because the roots were injured by the cold temperatures. So nutrient uptake has been affected and nutrient mobility within the plant has been affected. So the new growth may be kind of pale because of a nitrogen deficiency. That will correct quickly with warmer soil conditions. Fertilizer applied just for that purpose really won't make any difference. If you put something in when you planted them or you're in the habit of feeding young seedlings, your standard practice will be fine. You don't need to do anything special just because it has been cold. My expectation is that tomato seedlings that were put in the ground early will be set back a week to 2 weeks and ultimately will regrow and be fine. You didn't gain anything. My biggest concern actually is blossom end rot, that condition where the bottom of the fruit is getting softened and spoiled as it's ripening. The strongest correlation of blossom end rot is with plants that were subjected to cold, wet soil conditions when the fruit is either in the division stage, that is to say, cell division going on in the very small developed fruit, or the expansion stage. It's not real clear exactly where the problem sets in, but somewhere in there. So if there are first fruit that are on there, or there are fruit that develop very quickly after planting, very high likelihood that those fruit will have blossom end rot. Pick them off. I mean, you can monitor for it. It's pretty easy to see the early signs of blossom end rot. Usually you get some yellowish mottling and discoloration right away. Pick them off, throw them away, the next ones will probably be fine. If you're shopping for tomato seedlings, this is one of the more important ones. This weather has not been great for growers. They'll take them out of the greenhouse, they'll harden them up somewhat. Somewhere in that process, they can sometimes get early blight, which are spots on the leaves, late blight, which are bigger spots on the leaves. Both of those in our climate usually kind of go away when we get warm and dry. But don't buy seedlings that have them. Okay, so look closely at the seedlings when you're looking at them to purchase at a nursery or a hardware store. If there are distinct spots on the leaves, one, you might bring it to the attention of the nursery staff politely. We don't need to be bombarded with this stuff. And they should remove them from display because the disease could splash onto nearby seedlings. You can look carefully, avoid those. Don't worry about slightly bleached out looking seedlings. Those just came out of a greenhouse. That's just environmental stress. But the little spots on the leaves, well, don't buy those. Okay. So that's tomatoes. But peppers and eggplants that were already in the ground over the last 2 to 3 weeks will almost certainly have pretty significant root injury. They'll be set back by as much as 2 to 4 weeks. And if you lost the growing point, which sometimes happens, just replace them. I mean, you're just gonna have to wait a month for them to regrow. Just get a new one, unless you're really patient. If they haven't started to put on new growth within, let's say, 2 weeks, I suggest you probably buy and plant some new ones. Cold damage to pepper and eggplant seedlings, in my experience, affects the whole season's growth and yield. So seedlings that are in pots, keep them near the house. Go ahead and wait till it's distinctly warmer, another week or so at least, I'm getting those out in the ground. But the main group of plants that I'm concerned about are Cucurbitaceae.
It's cucumbers and melons and that whole crowd.
Yeah, the cucumber family. Cucumbers, squash, pumpkins, and melons, and especially watermelons, which are very tropical plants. These all need to just grow vigorously from the start. You don't want anything to inhibit their growth. And if you put them into cold soil, they're very adversely affected by low temperatures. I would prefer to see nighttime temperatures at 60 degrees, 55 absolute minimum for them. If you already planted squash, melons, cucumbers, pumpkins, well, wait and see what happens. They might outgrow it, but there's a pretty high likelihood that those seedlings will struggle and you'll probably be better off putting new ones in, even just planting some new seed when the soil is warmer. Also, it's picnic day this Saturday. Picnic
Picnic day, picnic
day.
day.
I'm tired already.
Oh, you've got to watch the parade, Don. There's so many
I
meat
know.
people.
I've got a business to run. It's open on that day, and all of us who have retail businesses just okay. It's a crazy day in Davis.
Well, just find one of those webcams that shows Picnic Day parade and watch it in your store.
If you're new to the area, 50 to 80,000 people descend on a town whose population I believe is about 65,000 people right now. And the best place to go on picnic day is the campus. I strongly suggest, especially if you're bringing family, go on the campus. Stay on campus. They don't allow alcohol on campus. So it's a fun day on campus and a crazy day in town, but there's lots. And I mean, every department practically has an open house during picnic day. And I'll just mention the vegetable photo station. You can either be a vegetable or just look like one. Okay, that's at the Plant
What?
Environmental Sciences Courtyard, April 20th, 8:30 a.m. to 3 p.m. Go over there and get your picture taken as a tomato or a carrot, apparently from the picture. Or you can go to the entomology department and see a display of fluorescence in insects. What? Glowing insects, you say? Yep, 9 to 5 on picnic day. Or if you're a fisher person, you can learn the art of fly tying from fly fishing experts.
You say that 3 times.
Fly tying
No,
from
no,
fly
don't, Dan. Don't. No.
fishing
Yeah, it was a
experts. Okay,
joke.
here we go. That's at the Briggs Hall Courtyard, which is right near the glowing insects. And there's other creepy crawlies and tarantulas and scorpions and millipedes and so forth, also at Briggs Hall. Or you can do maggot art. Okay, now this is an easy one. You just take some maggots and you drop in paint, non-toxic, and then you put them on a piece of paper and watch them crawl around. And then you can put that on your refrigerator. So this is
Not the
just
maggots, just the painting after it's
Just
all
look
done.
like that's also in the Briggs Hall Courtyard. Now, those are
Oh.
just 4 of the events going on Picnic Day. Picnic Day is all over town, all over campus. You can't miss it if you come to Davis. That's this Saturday, April 20th, all day long, all throughout the community.
And I strongly recommend that you use a bus to get around because the campus buses run, and if you're trying to drive towards campus, oh, that's just crazy.
Okay. That's our public service announcement. Don't try to drive to Davis on picnic day. Okay, just for the record,
But come back on Whole Earth Festival. Okay, now.
here's a funny one. Just so you know, yes, we are open on picnic day. That's the most common phone question we get. Are you open? Yes, we are open. Yes, that was.
Well, you know, it used to be that the businesses along the route of the parade weren't open. They would close
Yeah, they
during
would. We're
the parade because it's just, you couldn't get through, you couldn't get in.
the downtown businesses closed. We are not technically downtown, but it's funny to get that call over and over again. Yeah, we're here. Come on down. Great time to plant tomatoes. We got 47 varieties exactly, by the way, at the moment. Okay.
Ooh, I'll have to go check that out. Okay, you know you're going to get this question all the time. What's your favorite variety for this year, Don?
For this year, oh well, I have a list of 20 that we hand out quite regularly, and I've narrowed it down to five or six. But it's interesting that list has changed somewhat over the years.
Yeah.
It's a question of whether it's for productivity and reliability, like Champion, which is just both of those, or whether it's got the unique characteristic that I like, which is making a really good sauce or salsa. That's where that one I've mentioned many times, and we're kind of an exclusive on it, called Rugby, has become one of my absolute top favorites because it's a very meaty tomato. It makes a great sauce. You don't have to cook it down all that much to get a really nice sort of chunky sauce or salsa. It was introduced to me by a customer 5 or 6 years ago. I don't know, he sat at a dinner party with a breeder or something like this. Came out of Bulgaria. That's where we had to buy the seed originally. Now you can get seed for Rugby here in the United States. It's just one of several new, what I will call sauce or cooking tomatoes. That's really been an area, it's sort of a minor area of breeding for years and years, and now it's sort of catching on that there's more people that want to process tomatoes, and they want ones that give you a lot of volume. I planted one last year called Super Sauce. There's another one called Big Mama. These are all big, meaty sauce tomatoes, and I've grown them all, and so far Rugby has out-yielded all the other new ones, but they're all very good. And what I will say is, for those of you who, like my father, love San Marzano, because that's a sauce tomato. That's the classic heirloom Italian sauce tomato. Try one of these new ones. It doesn't have to be Rugby. Try one of the other ones. I was barely picking San Marzano last year because this one across the path had such bigger, meatier fruit in such great abundance that it pushed San Marzano off my list. And
Ooh.
that takes some doing, let me tell you. Okay. There's also a couple new, Brad Gates from Wild Boar Farms has a couple new ones. He has a new cherry tomato. He now has like six or seven.
Is
All
it called Piglet?
no, it's
Oh.
called Tim's Taste of Paradise. Tim's Taste of Paradise. Every year that he comes out with a new cherry tomato, okay, full disclosure, I'm not a big fan of cherry tomatoes. I don't really use them all that much, but I do want to grow them to see how they do and how their flavor compares to the two most popular ones, Sun Gold and Sweet 100. Tim's Taste of Paradise is said to be better than Sun Gold. Okay. They said that about Barry's Crazy Cherry, one of his introductions from 3 or 4 years ago. It out-yielded Sun Gold. It was easier to pick, and it was sweeter. So that was Barry's Crazy Cherry. Now we have Tim's Taste of Paradise. I would try one of them if you're interested and see how you think it compares to Sweet 100 or Sun Gold. Those are still the sort of the standards of the industry now for cherry tomatoes for home gardeners. He's got a new one. It's worth a try. Apparently, very heavy yielder, very, very sweet. There's two basic types of cherry tomatoes: tart and juicy, your classic red cherry tomato, and smaller and sweet, like Sun Gold. And once Sun Gold came on the market, it has ever since then been our top-selling cherry tomato, and right up there is one of our top-selling tomatoes because they're pretty, they're a golden orange color, they are very sweet, they're that kind of flavor profile, not the tart, more perhaps astringent flavor of a classic cherry tomato. People immediately migrated to Sun Gold. Sweet 100, Sweet Million, those are also very good small red tomatoes, but they're more in the tartar flavor profile. So you can get into the nuances of flavor profiles of tomatoes. In general, I will say this: a tomato that you grow to full ripeness in your garden will taste better than any other tomato you've ever had because you can allow it to grow to its full ripeness before you pick it, and it will be sweeter no matter what. So far, I'm going to say this again, these new purple tomatoes don't impress me. The flavor, I don't like it. We all found them astringent at our nursery. We waited later and harvested them. We didn't like them. So far, that's a color breeding trend that I'm not real impressed by. But otherwise, you're just getting sweeter and more productive varieties as time goes by.
And remember, it's time to plant tomatoes,
It's time to
finally.
plant tomatoes. And there's no hurry. You can plant them all through May, all the way into June. The latest date I've ever planted tomatoes now, I push it back every year a couple weeks, August 1. August 1, planted four tomatoes, each of which in October gave me about 20 fruit. So we have a long season here. Okay, next topic.
So Melissa is writing to us, and she sent us a picture. Thank you, Melissa. It's a beautiful picture. And the title of this email is Floppy Felicia Amelioides Daisy Plant. I'm not sure I pronounced that correctly, but boy, that's a tongue twister. Yes. Hello, Lois and Don. We have this plant that looks great last year with a wonderful dome-shaped habit. This year, it has flopped and left a hole in the center. Please see pictures attached. Maybe I didn't get short enough in the past year. Perhaps it needed more compost or fertilizer. Is it too shaded? And she has a picture. And I think I can answer this one. I'll try, and then Don will correct me if I'm wrong. This is a daisy bush that flowers at the, it has little stalks with flowers on it out at the edges. So if you have a bush that's 6 inches, let me start that again. If the branches are 6 inches tall, then it can hold itself upright. If the branches are 12 inches tall, it might have a little more trouble. Once the branches get to, well, I don't know, 18 inches long, they're going to fall over because of the weight. So my theory is that this is simply falling apart in the middle because the branches are heavier this year than they were in the past because you let them get longer. If the plant is more grown up. So I would say, maybe cut them back heavily and maybe they'll grow back a little bit more bushy.
Yeah, but you can try that. There's several plants called Marguerite, and this is one called Blue Marguerite. It's a true blue color, which is pretty amazing in the garden. I can tell you from a nursery standpoint, they're breakable plants. They're very fragile, and I have very few growers that do them, but they're really tough garden plants once established. Unlike most Marguerites, which are classic daisies, that's what people, when people are thinking of that daisy flower, if they aren't thinking of the golden bush daisy, they're thinking of Marguerites, most likely. Been moved to the genus Argyranthemum by the taxonomists. They used to be in the genus Chrysanthemum. Most people knew that one pretty well. Most of them are 3x3, rounded shrubs, sometimes bigger, bloom heavily in the spring here in the Sacramento Valley, longer into the summer in coastal zones. And they're generally 3 to 4 year plants. They're just one of that category of somewhat soft wooded shrubs that people plant as if they were perennials, and you get 2, 3, 4 years of bloom out of them, and then they fall apart in the middle, and that's just kind of the way it goes. That's what people expect, and it is the pattern. This one doesn't grow up as much as it goes out. It is the nature of Felicia to spread. So a third year plant will be 1 to 1.5 feet tall and 3 feet or so across. The more shade they're in, and I do see this one is in some shade, they'll bloom fine, plant looks great, but they will sprawl more. They'll be stretchier because of just their less sunlight, and it will take full sun. That's an important thing to know. This is a surprisingly tough little plant. People do try cutting them back hard, as with other soft wooded plants like lavenders and such. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. If you cut them back 50% and you've cut into the wood, sometimes they just die at that point. Okay, big deal, you go buy another one. Sometimes they resprout nicely from the interior. And so it's a bit of a gamble if you cut them back hard, but that would have prevented what you're dealing with here. More to the point, I like to use these types of shrubs as filler. Figure if you get 3 to 4 years out of it, will a larger woodier plant or a grassy or iris-like plant is filling in nearby, great. These go great with alstroemerias. They grow great with irises and things like that. Then when the other plant is doing its job, you can just go ahead and cut this out and plant another one somewhere else. Don't expect them to be long-term plants in the landscape, but enjoy the fact that they'll give you a massive bloom in spring and sometimes again in fall. Again, more through the summer and cooler climates for as much as 3 to 5 years. And at some point you'll just decide it's no longer filling its landscape function. The plant is fine. It doesn't care that it's bare on the interior, just like your lavender plant doesn't, but it may not be as aesthetic as you were considering. Hard pruning is worth a try if it's outgrown the location, being aware that there's a risk that the plant will simply die back at that point. I've tested this on lavenders many times because I plant lots of lavender on my property, and I'd say it's about 50-50 as to whether they resprout or just look so bad that I end up pulling them out and sticking a new plant in. We're not talking about a major expense here, and we're not talking about a big woody shrub or a tree. It's just part of your border. So if it happens to not work, okay, you've learned and lost. But there, it is a plant that the growth habit of what you're seeing is fairly normal. It's just exaggerated by the fact that it's in some shade. Try pruning harder if you wish. Then comes the key question, when? Well, midsummer isn't good, and that's too hot. So generally fall is when we do this, or early spring, but that cuts into your bloom. So my inclination is to let these things grow, bloom their hearts out, bloom their way out of their position, and replace them with something else. But that's because I'm a nursery owner and I have a conflict of interest in this subject.
So Melissa ends her email with, "I'm in Glendale, California." Is that coastal done?
Yeah, sort of.
Okay. And she writes, "Please keep up your great work. We enjoy your garden wisdom and look forward to each episode." Thank you, Melissa. So I have a thought for this plant and for anything else that, flops over and gets bare in the middle and you don't really want to look at the bare stems. Well, you could cover that up with something interesting, like, have you ever seen one of those wire or wrought iron tables? Just a little tall table, maybe a couple feet tall, and it's got the wrought iron around it, and then it's got a circle on the top, and you put a something on it. You could put a tabletop or whatever, or you could put a bird bath up there. So you could nestle the legs in the middle of your plant, and then put a bird bath on top, and you wouldn't be at all dismayed by the little bare stems underneath, because you'd have lots of fun.
Yeah, you have birds coming in, or you can just plant these close to more upright growing plants. One of the most common combinations, people buy marguerites thinking that they're more or less interchangeable. So they'll buy the blue marguerite, the yellow marguerite. Now there's pink and red ones. Mix them. If they're on 2.5 to 3 foot centers, it'll be one big old mass of marguerite, and those bare spots will be filled by the next plant over. So it's a beautiful plant. Nice picture. Thank you. Enjoy the season, and then you'll get to decide what to do with this plant when it's kind of finished out its bloom, which should, by the way, in Glendale, more moderate climate, should go longer into the summer than what we get here in the valley. Daisies for us, most of them are most of the ones, the woody, shrubby ones that people are thinking of, are winter and spring blooming things. The golden bush daisy, the gazanias, those are ground level herbaceous perennials, bloom heavily in the winter into the spring. Newer varieties continue into the summer, but typically they have been a cool season thing. And then we don't have that many midsummer daisies, except for the annual things like zinnias and asters and cosmos. And then back to the perennials, we have the late summer and early fall, we have Shasta daisies, which can bloom off and on all the time, but heavily in late summer and into the fall. And of course, Gloriosa daisy or black-eyed Susan and the Echinacea or coneflower, which are really important for that August to September bloom they provide here, particularly the Goldstern variety of Rudbeckia, which will start earlier and bloom later. It's a really good garden plant. So we can get here in the valley, we can get really cool bright flowered daisies from perennial plants August through May to June. And June, July, which are really too hot for most of the things I just described, the zinnias and the asters and the cosmos and the sunflowers provide that. Why are daisies so important? Because they are huge magnets for beneficial insects. It's hard for me to take a picture of cosmos in my garden without something landing on it while I'm taking the picture. Whether it's a beneficial wasp or a little butterfly or something, zinnias are the same way, and they all attract hummingbirds in a big way and very attractive to butterflies as well. So whether we're talking native, like the California aster, non-native garden plants, daisies are great things to plant amongst your vegetables and fruit trees and flower garden to draw beneficial insects in, pollinators, as well as things that will feed on aphids.
We have questions. Oh, we have, and these are current things that came into the garden center, and he wrote down and he sent them to me. So here we go. What's a fast-growing evergreen, drought-tolerant shrub to make a screen? We're talking hedging again, guys.
And we assume that this is someone who lives in this area. I mean, that there's a lot of very familiar things that are fast growing, but very drought tolerant. A hop seed bush, Dodonia. That one can be overwatered. Be careful. Make sure that's in a landscape where you're going to back off on the irrigation, but it can grow 3 to 5 feet a year. And it mixes very nicely with our native shrubs, such as the ceanothus and things like that, that also need to be basically unirrigated once established. We talked a little bit in a recent show about the Callistemon, the very upright form of bottle brush, and I'm increasingly impressed with these new cultivars of bottle brush. Those are two that are very popular. The one that I want to mention, and the reason I wanted to talk about this now, Photinia Fraseri, the red-tipped Photinia, has become incredibly popular for 30, 40 years now. It's got that big flush of red growth on it. It is fast growing. It will provide a screen very quickly. It's amazingly drought tolerant, actually. I have tested Photinia with very reduced irrigation, and it does great. I do want to mention, though, that you should not prune Photinia during that flush of new growth in the spring. Fire blight is infecting apple trees and pear trees in the region right now, and pyracanthus and other related plants in that branch of the rose family, and photinia is in that branch of the rose family. And it is one case where I have clearly seen infection through pruning wounds when maintenance gardeners come in as the photinia is flushing that beautiful red new growth and shear it all off. I don't know why they do that in the first place, because that's one of the features of the plant is that new growth on them. And unless they've been planted where you have to block, you know, keep them from blocking a window, I don't think it's appropriate to prune them that way anyway. But more to the point, anytime in April or May that you prune a Photinia fraseri, especially with a lot of new growth on it, you're inviting fire blight. So it's a great choice to answer this question, but not for pruning in the spring. Much better if you can let it grow to its natural 10 to 15 foot height, to let it grow more naturally, prune it more naturally, taking out just the branches that are getting too high rather than shearing it. Anyway, that's a bit of a rant, but it's because I'm really worried that people are going to go out and prune this weekend. This is fire blight weather right now. So you could unfortunately introduce an avenue for that pathogen to get in.
So the photinia has the red growth and it flushes and then it turns green. Doesn't the red turn green? Yeah. So when does the red turn green? And I think the probably the rule would be never cut a photinia when it's red, but when would it turn green?
About June. And you can do that pruning in June or in the summer if you want, or fall is a great time to do it as well. And of course, more natural pruning always looks better anyway. But if it's a big like commercial project and they've got to do the pruning, they've got to shear them, have them hold off until a mild spell in the summer, but we do have them, or fall would be even better. Now, if you like the look of Photinia, there's a closely related native plant, Toyon, which we mention all the time, which is a great choice for a screen. It's not as fast as Photinia, but mine have grown 3 feet a year, and they give those beautiful red berries in the wintertime, so Toyon is a good option. I would prefer always to see people mix species in a hedge, because if you do get fire blight on your Photinia, for example, well, there goes your whole hedge. But if some of the plants are Toyon, well, they can get fire blight, but not as commonly. Or hopseed bush, which doesn't get fire blight at all. Or Spirinothus, which is totally unrelated, doesn't get fire blight, has its own issues. But if you have a mix of things creating this privacy in an informal planting, if something goes down, like the hopseed bush gets Phytophthora, well, there's a plant right nearby to fill in. And if you particularly like natives, other than the Toyon, the Bacchus, coyote bush is another vigorous, fast-growing, upright shrub that you can prune any way you want. You can cut it to the ground, just as a fire would do in its natural habitat. That's great for coyote bush, so that's one possibility. There are many, many others. If you're looking for a big screen, you can buy things that are already big, like bay trees, already trained up, Boloris nobilis. You can buy it trained 8 feet tall. You can buy something that'll provide privacy almost immediately. Bamboo in a trough, a livestock trough makes a very quick screen. If you go to redwoodbarn.com and just type hedges and screens, I have a whole article, it's 11 pages long, on different things that'll provide rapid screening. Look at the irrigation requirements of each. Native plants, of course, you'll need to back off on the irrigation once established. That goes for some of the Australian natives as well, like grevilleas, which make fantastic barriers and screens, and the bottle brush, which is from Australia, same thing. Mediterranean plants are also compatible. So there's a lot of choices. Just be aware that every one plant, just as with trees, species diversity is really important. Every one plant may have its issue, so having a whole long row of one thing is kind of inviting a problem. A couple of people that I've known over the years, including one commercial installation, alternated, more or less, xylosma and feijoa. Xylosma is a shiny leaf shrub we've talked about many times on the show here. It's hardy to USDA Zone 8, so at least here in California, it's a great choice. Can be as big as a tree, but more commonly pruned as a hedge. Feijoa, now Acca siloiana, pineapple guava, does have fruit, but it's mainly grown as an ornamental plant in Northern California. The xylosma has shiny bronzy green leaves. The feijoa has dark green with a gray underside to the leaf, so the contrast of the foliage is great. Both can be unirrigated once established. They mix fine with California natives like Toyon or Bacchus. So those four or five species together could provide rapid screening and eventually would not even need to be irrigated, or just a deep soaking once a month would be fine. A mix of evergreen foliage will be a better, more successful planting in the long run. That doesn't lend itself to commercial management, and I have consulted many times on commercial landscapes where one of the first suggestions I typically make is that they make it clear to the maintenance crew that it's okay for them to back off on pruning. Because I've talked to the maintenance crews and I've talked to the homeowners association or property manager, and they're at odds with each other. The maintenance crews think they want everything pruned that way. They want it clipped. That's what they've always been doing, and no one has said otherwise, so they aren't being told prune these more naturally. And they all think that people will think they aren't doing their job if they let them grow more naturally. Now, in many of these consultations, I see totally inappropriate species. As a photinia is a popular shrub, putting it under a window is nuts. I mean, you'll have to prune it all the time. Why would you do that? But I see it all the time. So my suggestion when I'm in good fortune to be doing a consultation on that is, how about if you take out those photinias and I'll suggest some plants to replace them with it, they'll never have to prune. That's a much better bet in the long run. People almost always like a more natural looking landscape if it can be permitted to grow that way, but very commonly because of species selection, it can't be. So it's not the gardener's fault that they're doing what they think is expected of them with a plant that is going to outgrow the location. In some cases, it's a removal and a replacement. A mix of species, something with some seasonal color, berries in the wintertime, flowers in the spring. I mean, I've been in some of these evergreen hedge and shrub plantings that I've been advising on, I'll have them sneak in a flowering quince. Okay, it's deciduous, but it blooms in January. And not much is going on in January. It's still blooming now in my yard. So very long bloom season for that plant. I did Weigelia or Weigella, I've heard it pronounced both ways, in one mixed planting of evergreens. Well, again, it's deciduous. It looks best if you can let it grow fairly informally. So I made sure it had 6 feet of space. It's in full bloom right now. And the people who are on the landscape committee there go, oh, wow, that's really a cool shrub. Where'd that come from? I said, we planted that 2 years ago. But now
And
you
you
notice it,
didn't
and you'll
notice
notice
it.
it again next year at this time. So this is where those deciduous flowering shrubs can really fit in is with, all right, you've got a toyon, you've got a couple photinias, and you stick in a feijoa and just put in a flowering quince, and then go back and repeat one of the ones you started with. Much more effective in the long run. Anyway.
So I'm going to sneak in a question of my own here while we're going through all these questions. I have a Strelitzia, that's a bird of paradise, and I planted it out a few years back, and so it's been doing very well. It sets its flower stalk up 1st of January, and by the end of January, I have these gorgeous tropical looking bird of paradise flowers, and they're huge. I mean, they're huge. Okay,
Long
so
lasting too, yeah.
yeah, and they're still going. So that happened, and so this is now the mid-April. So this plant has been blooming January, February, March, April, 3 months. The other Strelitzia plant has just opened its first bloom yesterday. Why the difference, Don? Why would one be so early and continuous, and this other one waited until now?
I don't know. We all have late bloomers in our lives, don't
Oh, they're so cute.
Probably microclimate. That's the best I can come up with.
So maybe it was shadier, or maybe it was. Now,
Shadier, colder, whatever.
are these things that like your one that took 3 years before it bloomed, are these also going to take a few years before they bloom after you plant them?
Yeah, now I've got to emphasize, common names are a problem. There's lots of things called bird of paradise. You're talking about the classic plant called bird of paradise, Strelitzia. Yeah, there are shrubs that are called bird of paradise and so on. Any flamboyant flowered shrub or tree can have that name applied. We're talking about the Strelitzia, which people in coastal and Southern California know very, very well. Blooms year round in those climates. And individual bloom will last for weeks, if not months, and new ones are coming along. And the bigger the plant gets, the more blooms you get until eventually you get this massive thing that, as a teenager, I had to help dig up and divide more than once. And that's a tough, tough job. Let me tell you, they are a tough rooted plant. Hardy in USDA Zone 10, hardy enough in Zone 9B to be fine. In Zone 9A, they can get top damage but will recover. So, pretty much Zones 9 and 10, you can grow Strelitzia. They take a while to start blooming, but people like the foliage anyway. People are growing them as house plants now, and they're probably never going to bloom as a house plant, but they like the way they look. Sort of like a tough banana leaf is the way I would describe it. And they're good house plants, by the way, not hard to grow indoors, just don't expect to bloom. And as the, after 3, 4, 5 years in the ground, they bloom more and more and more. And every so often, you should go in and thin out the old spent blossoms, but they take months to look rough. I mean, really, it goes on and on and on. So it's one of those plants that basically needs a grooming every couple of years. Leaves get tattered, leaves get rough looking, so you go in and cut those out. And they're very fibrous, I can tell you from considerable experience. Sharp pruners are very handy to have for that. Sharpen your secateurs right before you begin the process, shall we say, and cut out the old leaves and thin them out every couple of years, and they'll come back just fine. But yes, they do take a while to get going. So you just have a late bloomer on your hands.
All right. I don't mind.
Yeah.
Maybe it'll go longer.
Could be.
It'll extend the season of the Strelitzia in my yard. That would be lovely. Okay, back to the questions. I planted passion flower and they got totally eaten by monarch butterflies, caterpillars. Well, I don't think it was monarch butterflies.
Correct. It was not monarchs.
It
But
was painted.
so the painted lady, or yes, painted lady, the question really was what to do about it. And I said, well, that's one of the reasons people plant passiflora is to attract the Gulf fritillary butterfly, actually, which oviposits on them. It looks like a monarch. People often think they're monarchs. It's a smaller butterfly, but it's also orange. And the larvae feed on exclusively on many, if not all, species of Passiflora, including Passiflora edulis, the passion fruit. They will apparently, I've never seen it, but they will apparently oviposit on those and feed on them. They will come up to certain species of Passiflora and will not oviposit on them. So there's some they don't use. That's the adults making the decision, not the larva. And there's some species that are planted intentionally for this purpose. And I have a list started of ones that I've definitely seen them on. If you're growing them for that purpose, the problem with planting a larval food source is they will eat your plant.
Yeah,
And,
well, that's the purpose.
well, they didn't think about this. So the problem is the plant will look very rough. I have a customer who has a whole 30-foot fence of a particular species of Passiflora that was planted by the previous owner. The plant itself looks ratty pretty much all the time. It is billowing with clouds of fritillary butterflies. This one planting alone is probably creating the population that is in much of East Davis. And so they just put up with that. But the appearance of the plant can be rough. Same thing with your milkweed. If the monarchs discover your milkweed, they'll oviposit, and the caterpillars, which are cute and pretty, will feed on it. Hopefully, you'll have enough there to sustain them because they eat a lot. You've probably read that book, Very Hungry Caterpillar. That's pretty much the whole plot line. And if you haven't planted a bunch of Asclepias, or you don't have a vigorous Passiflora, it can actually significantly impact the plant. In the case of the Passiflora, I had a customer a couple of years ago who planted one with the hopes of attracting them, and indeed it did, even while it was still just getting going. And she found she had to cover the plant, protect the plant with a barrier like a mesh or something, which is a hassle with a vine, for the first season to get enough vine up there that they wouldn't eat the whole thing. So that's what they do, is kind of the answer I gave. And no, I don't want you doing anything to kill those butterflies. Now, I've got to point out this is a non-native plant and a non-native butterfly. Gulf fritillary is not native here, but we now have enough people growing the right species of Passiflora that we have an established population of Gulf fritillary butterflies in Davis area and probably other parts of the Sacramento Valley. So that's what happens when you plant food for butterflies.
So, just to be clear, we misspoke earlier. It is not Painted Lady. It is Gulf fritillary. Different species of butterflies. Second is the kind of Passiflora that the butterflies eat, I think, is the kind that if it escapes into your yard, will grow everywhere and you will never get rid of. There are some passion flowers that are more conservative and they don't spread quite as far. But
It is true
be
that
careful. And if you even if you plant it in a pot, don't plant it in a pot on the soil, because as Don said, that connection between the top and the bottom, the roots could escape. Plant it on a pot on concrete
are we
and
speaking
then
from
watch it.
experience here, Lois?
Oh yeah. I still haven't gotten rid of all of that stuff, man. And I think the butterflies are cute. But this vine was taking over everything.
Oh yeah.
I mean, it was covering my plum tree. Can you imagine that covering a plum tree?
Yes, because in coastal areas, I grew up again in coastal San Diego. There were alleys down in downtown La Jolla that were completely filled with Passiflora. There are some species; it goes on a number of different species, and I just would be cautious about putting certain ones in the ground, but others are fine. And you need to read about them before you plant them. They're very cool vine. They're very, very attractive, vigorous plants. plant if you want to cover a screen or something. Yeah, some of them can root right out and sucker heavily and become a major nuisance. And again, I have a list going of which ones are attractive. There's more than 3,000 species and cultivars of Passiflora, and not all of them attract the Gulf fritillary butterfly, but many of them, if not most of them, do. And they are, again, a single passion flower vine at our garden center, which rooted itself from a container that was sitting on the gravel at the nursery next to the fence, has gone down the entire east fence of our nursery. And we have cut it back completely to the stump twice, and it just grows right on back. It's quite beautiful. It's the variety Blue Horizon. We like it. And it puts these funny little inedible fruits out. Okay, those are fine. We don't really mind those. But it's very vigorous. We are talking about something that has gone approximately 40 feet each time we've allowed it to do so. So it's a vigorous vine. As Lois has said, there are some less vigorous varieties. Containers are a great way to go, sitting on concrete, or just monitor them, but really monitor them. I mean, this is really the vine that can really get away from you.
And the other thing, question is that if you have a vine like that, that where you'd like the flowers, but you don't want to see the broken end, can you put another vine to grow with it that the caterpillar doesn't eat, and then that would keep it fluffy enough you could just see the flowers?
As you pull into the nursery, you'll notice that same 40-foot fence is covered with another vine that's commingled with the passion flower, which we also did not plant. That is the yellow cat's claw. And it's one of my favorite botanical names, Macfadyina unguis catti. Mr. McFaddy got a vine named after him, and unguis means claw, and catty means cat. So Mr. McFaddy's cat's claw, it's a yellow trumpet vine. It was a 5-gallon vine, we used to sell this plant 30 plus years ago, which fell off of the bench onto the ground. And we had to you water a nursery every day, everything gets watered every day. So it promptly rooted in and grew up onto the fence, along with the passion flower, which came a little bit later. It's gone 40 feet as well. They are fully commingled all the way down the fence. And when we had the fence replaced, the guy cut them all back to the stump. You could see the little stump where the yellow cat's claw, Macfadyina, was. And we just said, all right, don't worry about it. And he put the new fence in. It promptly came back. And within one season, it was all the way back down. So to answer your question, yes, you can plant an equally vigorous vine that will compete adequately with the passion flower. Make sure that they're compatible with respect to pruning and growth habit, and that you have a place where vines are appropriate. My worst garden mistakes have all been vines and roses, and mostly vines. So be aware of how vigorous some vines can be. Look at their growth habit, what they do. Do they sucker? Do they cling to things? Do they root into things? Or do they just scramble up and hold on with tendrils and are much more delicate looking little plants? Be aware that some vines can become a major nuisance.
So one last question from this list is, which potato variety tastes best? Don asked me that as we were getting ready to go on the show. And I said, the one that's in my yard.
The one that you've grown and just harvested will taste best, because honestly, the flavor of potatoes, with some exceptions, there's not major, major differences between, let's say, Red Norland, Yukon, Gold, Kennebec. Those are three that I happen to sell. But just dug out of the garden, it'll have a lot more sugar in it than if it's even sitting on your counter for 2 weeks, much less something you purchase at the grocery store. Because immediately, any plant, any food source that has sugar, as soon as it's harvested, will typically convert to starch. My grandfather, we would pull over at the produce stands in South Dakota, and we'd buy some fresh sweet corn and some cucumbers, and we'd head home and he'd put the water on right away. We weren't going to wait for dinner to cook that corn. We were going to have it now because it was sweetest. Now, corn breeders now have corn varieties where the sugar lasts longer. But anything that has starch in it, the sugar has converted to starch from the point of harvest on. So I will say that the potato you grow yourself, just like the tomato you grow yourself, the potato you grow yourself and harvest and then cook right away will have a very different, very impressive flavor. The fingerlings as a group, which I don't sell because nobody buys them, but you can find them online, tend to have nuttier, more distinctive flavors. They have unusual flavors. You would typically just grow these and steam them, cook them just as is, and present them that way, because you wouldn't use them for mashed potatoes or things like that. The flavor and the texture wouldn't be what you're after. But if you're into potatoes and you haven't grown fingerlings, and you mail order your potatoes in the fall or the spring, depending on where you are, try some. And I think you would find those have a distinctive flavor. I'm not going to say better because it's different, but the potato that you grow yourself will always have a better flavor than one you buy in the store. Isn't that true of everything we grow in our vegetable garden? But in this particular case, as with some of the vegetables in the winter where the chilling makes a difference in the flavor, it is the fact that it's fresh harvested that makes the biggest difference.
Okay. Do you have that flowering sage?
Yeah, sure. There are a lot of varieties of sage. Which one?
And the one with the purple flowers.
Oh, that narrows it down.
Okay. About 1,000, I don't know. First of all, sage usually means salvia, but there are other things which have sage in the name. Sagebrush, for example, is not salvia.
It means that, yeah.
And so...
Jerusalem sage is
formal. Hey, folks, if you're going to do this, bring a picture.
Picture is very helpful. There are actually at this point at least a couple hundred varieties of the genus Salvia in the nursery trade. A significant percentage of them are purple. That's actually a very common color. So really our question, and it's an extremely useful group of plants. I find them, they range from the native shrubs, which will suppress weeds because they get so dense and solid and cover quite an area, to those cute little flowering ones that you can buy in pony packs at garden centers with little red flowers, and a whole lot of herbaceous perennial ones. I probably got 10 favorite salvias, just among just the ones that I plant all the time. Amistad, some of the microphylla Greggii hybrids. At this point, the customer's eyes are glazing over. So we need to know, is it a shrub, i.e. a woody plant that stays there all the time? Is it a spiky flowering thing that dies to the ground but comes back year after year? Or do you plant it every year? So that would narrow it down to the shrubby types, native or non-native, the garden perennials, generally very tough, wonderful garden plants, but needing more water typically, or the flowering annuals that you stick in with your petunias, the annual sages, of which there are several types, some of which are actually perennial, but sold as annuals. So if we can narrow it down to where you're going to use it and what type of plant it is, that does make it easier. But it's one of the most versatile, diverse, amazingly useful groups of plants. The sages, just by common name, the Jerusalem sage, which is a different species, sagebrush, which is a very useful plant in low water landscapes. These are some of our best plants for xeric landscapes, some of our best plants for low water landscapes, there's a difference there, and some of them like water and do great in a normal garden. Many of them get quite big. Some bloom through the winter, so you've got sages that bloom at every time of year. If you're on Pinterest, I was briefly, and all I did was make a giant folder of salvia flowers. It's still there. They never go away. I don't remember whether you look for Redwood Barn. I think, yeah, redwoodbarn.com. Type that in. You'll find about 40 pictures I took of salvias because I went through a phase of trying to do close-up pictures of salvia flowers. And it's a really cool group of plants. And it attracts hummingbirds. They attract the big Xylocopa bees. They attract beneficial insects of all kinds. And they're just great plants to have in the back of the border in the case of those big perennial herbaceous ones. And in your low water landscapes, they are some of the most useful plants, including our California native salvias, as well as the southwestern salvias that bloom through the summer and fall.
All right. I don't know how much time we have left, but I want to go through this April calendar really quickly.
Sure.
And I'm going to just read the names of the flowers or the things that you have in here. Peony, spelled a really strange way. Did you really mean peony starts with a P-A?
P-A-E-O-N-I-A is the botanical name for peony. Yes, peonia.
Okay. Because I was used to P-E-O-N-Y.
That's the common name, yeah.
I see. Okay. Ranunculus, tulip, clivia, rosa, carpinteria, clematis. Oh, wow, Don, that's beautiful clematis.
Yeah, that's the earliest bloom on them. Yeah. Well, actually, some bloom in February, but yeah.
Sirius, looks like a cactus. Is that a cactus?
Cactus, yep. Night blooming cactus, yep.
All right. Sweet alyssum, iris, bluebells, pelargonium, berberis, viola, and aquilegia. Aquilegia is the
columbine.
Columbine, all right.
Berberis is barberry. There are barberry plants that are actually very attractive landscape plants. I know you guys on the East Coast are not planting barberries anymore. I guess they're invasive. It doesn't happen here. They're also very scratchy, spiny things, but they do have a beautiful bloom right now, and they're very attractive to songbirds. It's not a plant that I would sell or recommend a lot because, you know, it's a really thorny plant. And putting thorny plants in the landscape is kind of a rude thing to do to the next person who lives there. But birds love that. Songbirds like that. They like that crowded, spiny overgrowth. So if you happen to have a place where you can allow a barberry to grow to its full potential, you can think about it. Certainly in the Western states, Berberis darwinii is one of the most attractive. It's a big plant, 8 by 8. There was another botanical name you mentioned there that I want to address. Carpenteria is the bush anemone, which is a native plant here in California, Carpenteria californica. Beautiful flowers April into May for about 4 or 5 weeks. And they do look like an anemone or like a single rose, if that makes sense, you know, single row of petals. It's a lovely shrub. It does have the characteristic, people ask about it periodically, and I have no growers that are doing this anymore. It does have the characteristic of going kind of dormant in the summer. If it's unirrigated, it looks like it's dying, and it's not. It's just an estivation, a summer dormancy, which can be quite unattractive. But if it's mixed in appropriately to a native plant landscape, I suppose that could be okay. And the other one that you mentioned that I think is worth a little discussion is Clivia, or Clivia, as my British customers pronounce it. It's a bulb plant from South Africa, which has big, strappy, dark green leaves. Coastal listeners probably know it pretty well. It is hardy here in the Sacramento Valley into USDA Zone 9, Sunset Zones 8, 9, and 14, as long as it's in a sheltered location, which it kind of has to be because it needs shade. In fact, it will grow and bloom in deep shade, unlike almost anything else. The best plantings of this in downtown Davis, right near where Union Bank used to be, there was a breezeway completely covered. Nothing would grow in that. Even things like Nandina wouldn't grow there. Well, they stuck in some clivias, and year after year they would bloom there. So it's a plant that will give you these bright orange flowers once a year in the month of April. Nice, attractive tropical foliage the rest of the time. Protected from frost, but it will be because of where you plant it. And it does this every year. So it just gets bigger and bigger. They're expensive, but they'll last for decades, and they're easy to divide every so often. It doesn't rebloom. The color is basically orange, bright orange. There's darker orange versions. There's a yellow version that came on the market. I remember when the yellow clivia came on the market and the 1 gallon plants were wholesaling for $50, more than 25 years ago, because it was new and novel. And so retailers were pricing those at like, you know, 100 and something, and that you don't sell a lot of them at that price. They've come down, they're a little less expensive. Sometimes a variegated leaf version will come along that sells for a very high price. But your basic old orange clivia is a great garden plant because there's not much else that gives you that spectacular color in total shade. It is a shade blooming perennial plant. Hardy enough to go down to about 28, 29 degrees, and very likely to have frost protection if you plant it in that much shade anyway, because whatever is providing the shade probably will provide frost protection. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
And Lois Richter here at KDRT-LP 95.7 in Davis, California.
KDRT is community radio. That means we rely on contributions from listeners like you to fund our operating cost. If you like what you hear, head on over to kdrt.org and click on the support button. While you're over there, check out the other great programming here at KDRT. On a Constant Grin, DJ Chris Musson presents all things modern indie, from shoegaze to psychedelic, dream pop to space rock, lo-fi to indie folk, whatever you prefer on your indie playlist. A Constant Grin is sure to keep you smiling. That's live Fridays, 2 to 2:30 p.m. Replays a couple times during the week. So for the rebroadcast time for A Constant Grin and all the other great programming here at KDRT, just check out the schedule guide.